had to take a flap and match it, you see. So we did that. We did that for a while. The other boys taught high school in South Vancouver. Well, I went back to work.
Was this back at the pharmacy in Georgia?
Back at the pharmacy on the corner of George and Granville. And I hadn't been there very long till the man who was on the night job got sick, and they asked me if I would take it on temporarily, as I had done before I went overseas. So I said, okay. But the imps was on temporarily. I'm not going to be tied down to night work again like I was.
You've done
before.
It for years before that, haven't you?
Yes, oh yes. Between 3 and 4 years, yeah. So the eventual happened. The fellow wouldn't come back on. He couldn't sleep at night. He couldn't sleep in the daytime when he upset. So I was stuck there for a while again. Then one day, Mr. Orme happened in the store about 8 o'clock in the morning. You see, I was on till 8:30 there alone. And then he said, how'd you like to go north? I said, I would, because I want to get away from this night job. So he said, okay. I said, well, and he offered compensation, which would be about $30, $40 a month more than I would get in Vancouver, but because not many fellows would go north, you see. However, this was a chance to get out of the all-night work, and so I went north to Prince Rupert.
Now, were you working for Mr. Orme at this point?
No, I was working at the Georgia Pharmacy, according to Georgia and Granville.
No, when you went up north?
I went north, oh yes.
But you were working for Mr. Orme?
I was up for Mr. Orme, doing the dispensing up there, you see. And that was fine, except that in the meantime, I had met Mrs. Mack, the present Mrs. Mack, you see, and she was in the Okanagan, and I was in Prince Rupert. We were 600 miles apart. And that wasn't too good. And when I had, if I come down and see her, say at Christmas, something like that, I'd spend about a week coming and going on the boats, you see, and trains for 24 hours in Summerland, you see. And that is no good. So after a couple of years, I decided I'd like to come back down. So I come back down to the Georgia again, but definitely this time, no night work. But at that time, Mr. Orme imagined contacted me again and said, how would you like to open a prescription store, like McDonald's prescriptions in Vancouver? How would you like to open a prescription store in Victoria? I said, I'd be on. But I said, remember, I've just come back from overseas. I don't have much capital. He says, all right, you do the work, I'll supply the capital.
And that's how McGill and Orme started?
That's how McGill and Orme started, yeah.
That's one of the largest on the island, I guess. Is it the largest?
Oh, it is, yeah. There are 10 or 11 stores in town here, and they have one surgical supply now in Nanaimo, which they opened just recently. So that's the start of it. But unfortunately, the date was the 7th of November, 1930. And the bottom fell out of everything on the 1st of November that year. It happened in New York. The stock market fell apart about the last week in October. And it hit Victoria that first week in November.
Oh, my God.
And people around that were millionaires or half millionaires were suddenly dead broke. One chap came in one day and asked for 10 cents for the stuff for his wife. And he apologized for it. He said, you know, 3 weeks ago, I was worth $500,000 in CPR stock, 10 cents. And so we dispensed prescriptions for fruit or vegetables or pictures off the wall or anything that the people would care to give us for medicine. Nobody had any money.
We were virtually bartering then.
We were bartering that first 6 months. That was in November. Well, and a good many times that first winter, I said, this is hopeless. I might as well throw up the sponge. But Mrs. Mack had kind of been saying, don't you do it now. As long as Mr. Orme will keep you going, you hang on, things will turn. And the next July, I was keeping records every week, doing all the bookkeeping myself. And it was starting each week was a little bit better than the previous week. And I just kept on creeping up, creeping up, creeping up, creeping up like that. And I said, we're hanging on because It's going to go over. But, you know, Victoria is a place where they'll walk past your door for a couple of years and never come in. But if you stay with it long enough and they decide that you're going to stick, then they'll start to come to
you.
And word of mouth helps, you see. But it took us, I forget, 3 or 4 years to recover the losses of the first two years, you see, before we started to get above board. So
I got to stop here and go back now. I got 3 questions to ask you. First one is, you were in a plane, and then the next guy that took off of the plane, the wings came off?
Oh, well, this is a way back. Well, this happened twice. It happened in England, it happened in Scotland.
This is during training?
This is during training, oh yes. The one in Scotland is probably the one that I may have mentioned. And this is the story that Gertrude brought up a few minutes ago.
Mm-hmm.
At Turnberry in Scotland, that's the golfing hotel, that was our headquarters, and I had a room on the third floor, the top floor. But I arrived in Turnberry from Houghton Park on the Mersey in England,
mm-hmm.
and I arrived the first case of influenza pneumonia.
Right, you had mentioned that, yes.
Yeah, and I knew it was coming, and so I got all the medicine and a big shot of brandy and went to bed and knew that my only hope was to sweat it out, which I did. Did I tell you that?
Yes.
I sweat through a mattress and a half. That much.
The guy used to come in the morning to see if you were still alive
or
something.
Yeah, yeah. And on the third or fourth morning, my eyes were open and he asked me if I was alive. I said, I think so.
Oh,
well. But that was it. I had probably perspired about 25 pounds or something like that, you see. Just completely dehydrated. Well, of course, I lost a month there, recuperating. But I did get back to flying again. But I was going to say, this was a big aerodrome there, but it was mostly two-seater reconnaissance and bombing people that were training. But on the way in the corner of the aerodrome next to a hill was a one little hangar with the Sopwith Dolphins and fighter, single-seater mm-hmm. fighters. They're the only ones on the aerodrome. And to lead up to complete the story that Kurt wanted me to tell, we found out that at least once they discovered sawdust in the floor in the morning, bits of sawdust. And in tracing it, they found that a longeron had been half sawn through. So the rumor soon got around that there was a spy somewhere in the neighborhood. And so I expect they probably doubled their
security people
around there. But anyway, we kept on flying. But one day, the aerodrome was like this, and there was huge hangars here. And we were way off here in the corner. And on this aerodrome was a whole row of these two-seater planes, half, two-thirds of the way across the airplane, lined up. And I took off straight this way into the wind. And I was only up 200 or 300 feet when I got all the hot castor oil from the engine in my face and all down me. One of the oil lines had burst or loosened, and I got all the oil in my face and down. And then sputtering and trying to get off my goggles and so on, I couldn't see a thing, you see, I was just feeling. Finally, I got my goggles up and got my hand over my eyes. And between the fingers, I could get a glimpse of the ground. And by this time, the oil was pretty well all on me, you see. And I could see down here in this line, there was a blank space about maybe 30 feet wide. I said, I think I could make that without smashing my plane and a couple of bombers at
the
same time.
The ones that were lined up on the ground.
So I had shut off the engine, you see, and came down quickly to get enough speed to come down and just headed for that opening. And I stopped exactly wing to wing with the bomber on each side, and only about that much to spare in the wingtips. Well,
what was
my reaction? I figured what had happened. Said that spy had been at work again, and he'd loosened some of the oil lines, you see.
You figured the oil lines were loosened?
I figured that, yes, because that the vibration of taking off had just broken apart, you see. But it made me so mad. I was bloody mad, aspiring to be the trooper. So I shot full throttle on and just taxied at full speed across to that hangar and stopped and shouted for the mechanic there. And I said, look what I'm up against here. And he said, oh my God, look at all the oil. So he scraped as much oil off me as put in that. I said, well, now take this and put it through the ringer. Get the rest of this castor oil out of it. And I beat it up to the back home. Well, that was one day. I figured that's what it was. Then another day later on, there was a little lake at the bottom of the aerodrome, and they had a small airplane, you know, about 15 or 20 feet, floating on this lake, and you were to go up 2,000 feet over it, you see, and flip over and come straight down on it firing, you see, come out, take off, and do that. I forget how many times we had to do that, 3 or 4 times.
It's part of your training again.
Part of the training, you see. Go up and flip over and dive straight on it with guns firing, you see. And I had done that this day, and I'd gone from the aerodrome, I'd gone back to the hotel and was up in my room on the top floor, and I went to the window and I saw somebody doing the same thing. I realized that it was the same machine that I had been, that Dunbar, pal of mine, was up doing the same thing. And so I was, nothing much to do, I was just watching him do his work, you see. But he was a little bit ham-handed. He did it a couple of times. I said, didn't feel good. So he's pulling out too hard. He's pulling it out instead of flying it out of the dive, mm-hmm. you see. And the third time he came down, he just yanked the wings off. And he went 200 miles an hour into this water, you see, which is harder than ground.
Sure.
And, well, there wasn't a piece of that plane bigger than a match, and every bone in his body was broken. Just like, oh, terrific.
Well, you figured that was just a regular stress.
I figured this, that that plane might have stood that, except there may have been a weak spot on it. I wonder if one of those longerons had been tampered with, and that this extra strain is just sufficient to flop the whole thing apart. So, I was only there a few days after that, before we went overseas, but I was very careful, the machine I flew after that place, because that was way off in the corner, and I said, well, somebody in the neighborhood could have easily crept in at night and watched his chance to get in there around the guards, get inside, do some monkey work. It might have even been one of our mechanics. Mm. Might have been a spy. It's hard to say. But that was the incident that Kirk had heard for the first time the other night.
That's my two
when
questions.
Somebody was talking about spies, and I happened to mention this out of treaties.
Well, did you blame gremlins at this time, or were gremlins the Second War?
Oh, gremlins of the Second War, yeah. No.
We didn't blame gremlins for that, eh?
No. But I think they were definitely a spy.
You mentioned before that there was a lot of complaining about, like, with amongst your colleagues, about the poor equipment, especially these rebuilt Hispano-Suiza engines.
Yes.
Do you know if your complaints were answered at all, or...?
No, you see, the demand. The Hispano-Suiza was used by the SE-5s, which were built in England, you see. They used a 190 Hispano-Suiza. Then there were the 5 squadrons of Dolphins in France using that same machine. So the demand and also all the training that was going on in England, and I don't know how many people were building these Hispano-Suizas. I know that there was 2 or 3 different firms building these,
mm-hmm.
but they weren't able to keep up for the demand with new machines, and they'd do anything to keep the pilots in the air, you see. So they with any machine that they could do anything with, they'd pull it apart and put it together again. But some of those machines were anything but smooth running. They were terrible.
Well, you figure the equipment...
They couldn't make the new machines fast enough, or they were making so many other airplane machines for the whole Air Force that they couldn't keep up with the demand, and the result was that... and also, the Americans had come in at that time, and they were probably trying to get them supplied with machines too, you see. The demand was so great. And so that anything that could be made to work to any extent at all was in use, and some of them were terrible. As you see, I had a crankshaft break, and one day and 2 days later, a camshaft break. Well, that could only be from poor alignment and
poor alignment and grinding
poor something grinding, poor, just terrible. We got so, during the last month or two of the war, but we simply hated to go over the line very far. We always wanted to be within volplaning distance of our own side of the line, because we were losing so many men with dud motors.
Dud motors as opposed to enemy action.
Far more than enemy action. Dud motors, yeah.
Dud motors.
Just conking out over the line.
Down you go.
Yeah, down you go.
Well, this brings me to the last one. Speaking of enemy action, you had mentioned that you had chased an observation plane, but you couldn't get any higher. You were hanging on your prop, you said.
Yes, that's right.
Did you see any other action other than that?
Oh, yes, we saw action, two or three times a week. Sometimes sometimes it'd be nothing.
Well, you don't mention that at all. Is there any reason for that?
Yes, I don't know. Nobody wants to mention that, because everybody thinks, oh, well, an ace always brings down 40 or 50 planes, or you've got to shoot down 5 planes before you get mention of any kind at all. And it doesn't matter how many fights you're in or how close your shaves are, so you prefer not to say anything about it. This is what I say. I'm a much better pilot than I am a marksman. That's it, period.
I think we're done.
I've had lots of bullets coming at me, and with the tracers in them, you can see them coming at you, but fortunately, there were no direct hits. Let's say that.
Good. Now, you don't have to answer me. I know. I was wondering, did you shoot any others down? Do you know? Or pretty good idea?
No, I think I probably damaged some, but I couldn't swear that. With all the turmoil that I really got anybody.
Oh, what was it like? Was it just all hell breaking loose? Or
yes. Oh, yes, yes. It's a case of you firing at the other fellow firing at you, and you're turning around.
How many planes would be involved?
There might be, in a dogfight, there'd probably be 50 planes involved. Or there might be only half a dozen planes involved. But everybody was after everybody else. And the thing is, you tried to get into a vertical turn, you see. And it's hard for the other fellow to get, and maybe you can see the other fellow if you think you might get a chance at him, change dive at him, you see. But, you take Huntley Sinclair at the affair in Edmonton the other day. He had to fly to one of the toasts, and during the conversation, he happened to mention. He said, "There were so many fellows there that had big records, you see, so on." And he said, "I'm one of those fellows that, he said, I've been credited with half a plane." In other words, two of them were firing at him, and he went down, but no knowing who, so it's half a plane each. But during the time that I was there, I must admit that we had it pretty easy. The real war was over, and the Heinies, except on occasion, were pretty well keeping to themselves. They were short of gas, they had no rubber, they were in a bad way quite a bit of the time, but every once in a while they'd put on a little show, you see, and they'd put on a super jasta, and they'd get 30 or 40 squadrons that were in flying condition, and they'd come over in one whole bunch.
Would this be the big flying circus type thing?
I've been under one of those. We were just five of us, one flight at 17,000 feet, and they were 2 or 3 feet above us, 2 or 300 feet, 2 or 3,000 feet above us, you see. They must have been about 20,000 feet. We were at 17, and we had been up for nearly 2 hours, so we had very little gas left. So we were very anxious to get out of this because we didn't want to get into anything because we only
did
had,
they chase you down?
We only had 10 or 15 minutes gas left.
Did they chase you down?
No, these fellows, I could see them yet. There were not less than 50 or 60 of them above us. But for some reason or other, we were flying here. But some reason or other, they were heading south. I don't know what it was. They may have been heading for the Americans or something like that. But
evidently, couldn't be bothered with it.
Evidently, they didn't intend to do anything to us. We were five of us flying here, and we were heading home with only a few minutes gas left, you see. But there were just swarms of them all.
What kind of planes were they, do you know? Do you remember?
All kinds of planes.
Big Fokkers,
there
were Albatrosses, and everything.
They were all single-seater fighters, you see.
Would these be the triplanes?
The triplanes were all over with by that time.
They were all finished,
yes. They were all finished, yes. They were practically all Fokkers, and there'd be some of the later models of the others, too. The names don't come to me right offhand. I knew half a dozen of them.
Mm-hmm.
But generally speaking, there were occasions when we'd go up, you see, and they told on the map we had to patrol between two points on the line.
Mm-hmm.
That we'd go and fly that. You're supposed to fly that back and forth, you see, protective patrol,
mm-hmm.
and or offensive patrol, and not an enemy in sight. So we came back. So we knew that things were. We're winding down to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know why, but that was that. So we were very fortunate to, because a few months earlier that year, in April and May, the end of March, April and May, the life of a pilot at the front was 5 days.
Yeah. You'd mentioned
but they were really going to it. They were ground strafing. They were strafing the ground, and that's what I hated was ground strafing. You were flying. You're flying just 50 feet off the ground.
You like it up in the air.
Oh, the higher the better.
The higher the better, right?
Higher the better. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. But the squadrons were decimated. Lots of days they'd lose more than half of them in one show. But that was when the fighting was on, when we came in. I didn't come in till.
So you lost your
end of,
there, yes.
In August, you see,
mm-hmm.
early in August when I got to the front. I came over in July, but it was August before I got up to the front. And by that time, the worst of the show was over. And when I looked back now,
it was
now,
still
I
show
see,
enough, though, wasn't
oh,
it?
Oh, yes, oh, yes. Looking back now, I could see that it was going downhill. There was less strenuous fighting all the time. And, of course, the boys at the front. And the trenches and the artillery were just pounding blazes out of Heine. We had our map, you see, and we'd mark where the front was each day,
mm-hmm.
on the map, and there'd be a little bulge that we'd in, go into the German lines, and a few days later there'd be another bulge here, you see. They were just forcing them back and back,
just
pounding the daylights out of them, you see. And
there must have been some sight flying over the front from the air, eh?
I remember the day. I'll always remember the morning. I'd have to look at my log list before the day. But evidently, it was a big bash on when they really broke through the main Hindenburg line. We were up at daybreak, before daybreak, up in the air, and I can still see it. There were about four layers of clouds, and they stopped about 15 miles from the front, extended west from the front. There'd be a layer of clouds, say, at 5,000 feet. There was another layer at 10,000 feet, another layer at 12 or 13,000 feet, and we were up around 17 or 18,000 feet. And you'd see these, look down at these three shelves of clouds there, and looking east, there were practically no clouds. It was clear. But I don't know whether you can picture this. If you would take a handful of diamond dust with a searchlight shining on it and just sprinkle it like that and having it all flash on the ground. In other words, we stood up there 3 to 4 miles in the air and watched an artillery barrage that was super. Every gun firing just as fast as it could fire on the front and well, just obliterating
explosion.
Just obliterating the wow. German lines.
Gosh.
But I still see that just like a diamond dust, each flash of the gun, you could see it was still dark enough, you see, and dawn, that you could see the flash of every gun. And it was just as though you'd sprinkled diamond dust up and down the front like that. Just
I guess you couldn't hear anything over your engine.
You couldn't hear anything. You couldn't hear anything at all. But they were really turning a lot of metal on them. And here's another thing, and I've only seen this happen 2 or 3 times while I was at the front. Howitzers. The artillery fires that way. The howitzers fire this way.
Right.
And falls like that. Several times I've seen these howitzer shells pass in front of my propeller. At the apex of their...
Oh. If there are...
Yeah.
Is that right?
Fortunately, I didn't bump one of them.
Bump one of them.
Wouldn't have been here, but I've seen this shell that looked to be... Well, of course, it happened pretty quickly, yes, but it looked to be about the length of this table. It's probably twice that length. Just this black thing just
arcing over.
Just arcing in front of me, yeah. And once in a while, too, without any warning, you'd feel a bump in the air. And you'd know, well, there was a shell went by pretty close.
Well, I guess it'd push a lot of air, too, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Yes,
but I think there was an occasional direct hit, even from our own guns on our machines, but not very often.
No.
Not very often. Because generally speaking, well, the single-seater planes were above the trajectory, I think,
mm-hmm.
generally speaking, because we were supposed to be close to 20,000 feet.
Yeah, you were ceiling squadron.
Yeah.
Well, I think we're done, and thank you very much, sir. That's great.
Fine.